Celsus further explores the two sources of knowledge in a later work, An Eternal and Temporal Life. The former springing from the Holy Spirit, the latter from the light of nature. Man is both eternal and temporal. Still, each life is from God because there is nothing that does not have its origin in God. Jung is concerned here because of the title that Paracelsus has given to this particular work, Paragoyim. What does Goyim mean in Hebrew?
Means somebody who is not of the tradition of the faith, Gentile.
But I got the feeling that word means pagan, does it?
It translates as pagan.
Uh-huh.
Translates later as pagan. Metaphorical usage of it.
Uh-huh. Jung speculates, was he playing with words, or was it an involuntary avowal, a dim presentiment of the duality of the world and soul? Was Paracelsus really unaffected by the schismatic spirit of the age? Jung says that Paracelsus' skepticism and rebelliousness stopped short of the church, that his involvement with alchemy, astrology, and magic proceeds from the authority of the light of nature. Jung quotes Paracelsus, I under the Lord under me, and I under him outside my office, and he under me outside his office. Jung claims that Paracelsus never rose to the egoistic heights of Agrippa because Paracelsus felt at one with God and himself, that his mind was not involved with abstract problems or logical reflections so far as they became destructive insights. Then, reflecting on Paracelsus, one father and two mothers, Paracelsus, one father and two mothers, he asks, can one serve two mothers? Can someone as Paracelsus, who feels himself created by God, press God into service within the physician's office? Jung suggests that Paracelsus' words came less from reflection than from the age in which he lived. Quoting Jung, are we not, in so far as we are particles in the mass, gnawed at and determined by the spirit that runs through the masses? Our freedom extends only as far as our consciousness reaches. Beyond that, we succumb to the unconscious influences of our environment. In this situation, there remains in each of us a tremendous tension between the man who serves God and the man who commands God to do his bidding. The greater the tension, the greater the potential. The greater the tension of opposites, the greater the energy generated, and it is this precise condition in which Jung attributes Paracelsus' most endearing qualities, impetuousness, quarrelsomeness, hastiness, impatience, discontentedness, and arrogance, and the very prototype of Faust. Jung claims that the balance that was still maintained in the time of Paracelsus and Angelus Silesius had been lost to the 20th century, a time when ego fancies itself ever more godlike. According to Jung, there was no form of mysticism and magic that Paracelsus did not practice, and it was an age when everyone was conscious of the dark forces of nature. Astronomy and astrology were one science, chemistry non-existence except for alchemy as forerunner. Jung's enthusiasm for magic was naive to the extent that he appeared to be totally unaware of its dangers and took every opportunity to deride other doctors for their ignorance of the subject. Most doctors of this age shunned magic on religious grounds, but Paracelsus believed that nothing was without the purview of his investigations. About his railing against the medical authorities of the past and his contemporaries, Jung says that Paracelsus' arguments were seldom systematic or coherent. Quoting Jung, he was so unconscious of the conflict within him that he never noticed there was a second ruler in his own house who worked against him and opposed everything he wanted. Paracelsus did not see that the truth of the church and the Christian standpoint could never get along without the thought implicit in all alchemy, God underneath. Pursuing this, Jung says that one of the psychological effects of the situation is that language swells up, overreaches itself, becomes needlessly complex. Paracelsus was not above concocting intricate neologisms from Latin, Greek, Italian, Hebrew, and possibly Arabic. Even his native German tongue was not above manipulation. Much of Paracelsus' chicanery came directly from his thorough knowledge of folk superstitions and pagan lore. Quoting Jung, since earliest times, alchemy contained, or actually was, a secret doctrine. With the triumph of Christianity and the Constantine, the old pagan ideas did not die, but lived on in the strange arcane terminology of philosophical alchemy. Even though Paracelsus appeared to have a considerable knowledge of Hermetic literature, Jung claims that, like all medieval alchemists, he was unaware of its true nature consciously. Because he used alchemy largely to prepare his medicines and secret remedies, Jung suggests that we are apt to forget that it meant much more to him than that. Paracelsus' special predilection, as Jung calls it, made him the forerunner of modern chemical medicine, even though there is no evidence he held a deeper affinity with this ancient art. Paracelsus' belief in the life of nature, according to Jung, coincides with the sapientia, or scientia. Is that science?
Yeah.
Knowing. The central mystery of philosophical alchemy, and is personified in the Christ, the helpful son of the macrocosm and the other son of the microcosm, God and man. Christ Jesus crucified is the symbol of the macrocosm, savior of the whole race of man, the microcosm. The natural life of man, or the star in man, as used by Paracelsus and others, sounds harmless enough, says Jung, but they had no idea of the conflict that lay hidden therein. In the former, man's salvation is brought about by God. In the latter, it is brought about by the mind of man. In the one, man confesses, I under God. In the other, God under me. It was medieval alchemy, according to Jung, that prepared the way for the greatest intervention in the divine world order that man has ever attempted. The precursor of the scientific age when, quoting Jung, the demon of the scientific spirit compelled the forces of nature to serve man to an extent that had never been known before. It was Goethe's Faust and Nietzsche's Zarathustra that sprang from the alchemic aberration and this alchemic aberration, and quoting Jung again, were the roots, the preparatory process deep in the psyche which unleashed the forces at work in the world today. Science and technology, he continues, have indeed conquered the world, but whether the psyche has gained anything is another matter. Paracelsus' feelings of inferiority arising from his use of magic and the secret content of alchemy aroused the wrath of his pitiless internal judge, which Jung says is in all of us, even if we are not conscious of doing anything wrong. His magic and alchemy were opposed to the spirit of Christianity, whether Paracelsus was aware of it or not. I was going to go on and finish this off with the last chapter, which was the primordial man, but I didn't feel that my understanding of that chapter was such that I wanted to get into it. And so, I'll let Dan fill in.
Very good. Thank you so much. Well, Dan?
First, I want to say that Molly should underestimate yourself. It's not that you're inadequate to deal with the book. It's that the writing is so complex that it's extremely difficult.
Yeah.
I found it so difficult to differentiate, to be impossible in places. The integration was fairly easy. It was the differentiation, the understanding that was hard. I don't feel ashamed to say that, because Jung had the same problem with Paracelsus' writings. And I'll mention that. The other caveat is, I guess I should say that, because I had so much difficulty with this, the best thing that I could do was reduce it into terms that I could deal with, and thus into terms that I hope everyone else can deal with, after what was said earlier about the dangers of teaching something that you're not prepared for and reductionism. I should simply warn you of that. With that, here we go. Paracelsus is a spiritual phenomenon. It's by Jung, of course, in Alchemical Study. Most of what I wrote is quotes either of Jung or Paracelsus, very little editorializing. That's what I mean when I say it's reductionist, whatever. In the West, the medieval era preceded the classical era, and Paracelsus was one of the bridges that linked the two. So he's considered the father of modern medicine and one of the founders of the modern scientific tradition. There's a certain darkness implied when his name is invoked in modern textbooks or in conversation. Philippus, Aureolus, Theophrastus, Bombastus, von Hohenheim, Paracelsus, was born in 1493 in Einsiedeln and died September 21, 1541 in Salzburg. I begin with a quote from the epilogue of Jung's essay. This is the epilogue. I had long been aware that alchemy is not only the mother of chemistry, but is also the forerunner of our modern psychology of the unconscious. Thus, Paracelsus appears as a pioneer not only of chemical medicine, but of empirical psychology and psychotherapy. It may seem that I have said too little about Paracelsus, the self-sacrificing physician and Christian, and too much about his dark shadow, that other Paracelsus, whose soul was intermingled with a strange spiritual current which, issuing from immemorial sources, flowed beyond him into a distant future. It was precisely because he was so fascinated by magic that he was able to open the door to the realities of nature for the benefit of succeeding centuries. The Christian and the primitive pagan lived together in him in a strange and marvelous way to form a conflicting whole, as in other great Renaissance figures. Although he had to endure the conflict, he was spared that agonizing split between knowledge and faith that had driven the later epochs. As a man, he had one father, but as a spirit, he had two mothers. His spirit was heroic because creative, and as such, was doomed to Promethean guilt. The secular conflict that broke out at the turn of the 16th century, and whose living image stands before our eyes in the figure of Paracelsus, is a prerequisite for higher consciousness. For analysis is always followed by synthesis, and what was divided on a lower level will appear reunited on a higher one. And to follow the epilogue with a quote from the prologue, Paracelsus was an alchemical philosopher whose religious beliefs involved him in an unconscious conflict with the Christian beliefs of his age in a way that seems to us inextricably confused. Nevertheless, in this confusion are to be found the beginnings of philosophical, psychological, and religious problems which are taking clearer shape in our own epoch. This is the frame on which Jung hangs his description of Paracelsus. Paracelsus' biological mother died when he was young. Jung maintains that this influenced his later serving of two mothers, Mother Church and Mother Nature. Though the Reformation occurred during his time, he did not succumb to it, and though alchemy and ecclesia were virtually at odds with one another, Paracelsus served both faithfully, though probably not without inner conflict. This established the tension of offices that Jung emphasizes. Further, Jung states unequivocally that this internal opposition provided the intense energy and drive in Paracelsus that pushed to be so investigative and productive. Paracelsus was a prolific user of neologisms, no words. He invents them for two likely purposes, Jung says, to describe thoughts and ideas from his intuition that apply to his alchemy, and possibly also to hide his work in magic from the eyes of the churchmen. As we shall see, this and other things make the interpretation of Paracelsus' tract, De Vita Longa, very difficult. Magic, Paracelsus says, is the preceptor and teacher of the physician, who derives his knowledge from the lumen naturae, the natural light. This statement conflicts with Paracelsus' deep Catholicism. Though Jung does not reveal himself until the very end of the essays, he too apparently believes this, and it is in opposition to his own belief in a Christian God and the Church. I suspect that he also hides this fact out of fear of repercussion and repression from the church and the civilized world. This is not only my impression. The editors state on the back cover of Alchemical Studies that, regarding the essays, quote, its striking effect arises most perhaps from the fact that Jung could identify himself with his dynamic and explosive countrymen, close quote. Nothing can be in man unless it has been given to him by the light of nature, lumen naturae, and what is in the light of nature has been brought by the stars, a decidedly pagan and heretical thought. But Paracelsus then subordinates this all-important light to the light of Jesus Christ. Jung states that a basic theme of Paracelsian thinking was the authenticity of one's own experience with nature, and in this attacked the traditional teaching of the medical schools. His students then took up the banner and attacked the Aristotelian method of science, thus bringing about the origins of modern scientific method. It also led to the conflict between knowledge and faith that, quote, poisoned the spiritual atmosphere of the 19th century, close quote. By this, Jung apparently means the antagonism between church and science which exists to this day. Quote, I'm under the Lord under me. I under him outside my office, and he under me outside his office. Evidence of a rather large ego and almost in conflict with its own belief in the Lord, while obviously in conflict with the church's teaching. Perhaps this idea led to the eventual suppression of the doctrines of alchemy and magic. Jung says, wholly and unremittingly engaged in the practical art of healing, his busy mind wasted no time on abstract problems, and his irrational, intuitive nature never pursued logical reflections so far that they resulted in destructive insights. The words that flowed from his pen came less from deep reflection than from the spirit of the age in which he lived. Close. The greater the tension, the greater the potential. This is what drove Paracelsus to greatness. Quote, not for nothing was Paracelsus the prototype of Faust, whom Burckhardt calls a great primordial image in the soul of every German. From Faust, the line leads direct to Nietzsche, close quote, and by inference, I believe, from Nietzsche direct to Jung himself. In the same paragraph, Jung warns the reader that, quote, dabbling in these arts, no matter how enlightened, is not without its psychological dangers. That's something that he addresses later on, and becomes fairly important both in what Jung says and in what Paracelsus himself wrote about and warned about. De Vita Longa, or De Vita Longa, an exposition of the secret doctrine of long life. This tract by Paracelsus was apparently not written by him, but was taken from lecture notes, translated by Operin, and edited by Adam von Bodenstein. It was described by the latter as taken from the mouth of Paracelsus and carefully revised. Jung seems to disagree about the careful revision. He says that it was written in bad Latin, Operin's fault, and though edited by von Bodenstein, who was quite fluent in Latin, it was not cleaned up. Jung contends that neither translator nor editor understood it well, if at all. Further, he states that his own interpretation must therefore be based not only on this, but on his own knowledge preceding and contemporary alchemists, and on Paracelsus' own pupils and followers' writing. Thus it seems that our formulas for lifetimes of greater than 1,000 years come from a loose interpretation of a sloppily written translation of lecture notes by someone who didn't understand what he was being told. That's editorial. The Iliaster. Life, by Hercules, is nothing other than a certain embalsamed mumia, which preserves the mortal body from the mortal worms and from corruption by means of a mixed saline solution. This is Paracelsus' formula for long life or for preservation of the body, uses a solution of the pulverized parts of Egyptian mummies. However, apparently there are other arcane remedies for relieving disease, which of course shorten life. It's difficult to understand Jung here, probably because he had difficulty understanding Paracelsus, but apparently these remedies essentially reinstilled the life principle, or spiritus mercurii, with a mixture of the four life-giving elements, gold, silver, quicksilver, and a certain yellow flower, cheri. They were held together with a component of pearls called quinta essentia, or quinta essentia. This is the balsam that restores or coincides the life force, which itself goes by many descriptions. Iliaster, that moist, breath-like, or vaporous soul dwelling in all bodies, principium, prima materia, chaos, prima compositio, air elementalis, air coelum, and spiritus vitae. All these were alchemical as well as Paracelsian names, indicating the importance of the soul in their work. The three components of the life force are Mercurius, Sulfur, and Salt. Most of this is in footnote 10, and it's followed by, it is thus identical with the mercurial spirit, which was a central concept of alchemy from the oldest times to its heyday in the 17th century. Like the Mercurius Philosophorum, the Paracelsian Mercurius is a child of Sol and Luna, born with the help of Sulfur and Salt, the strange son of chaos, as Goethe calls Mephistopheles. I suspect this indicates that the life force of the individual is thus a brother to the demon spirit of Faust. The Iliaster has three forms, Sanctitus, Caritatis, and Magnus, that are subordinate to man and can be brought into one Gamonimus, which seems to mean they can be brought together in a single hermaphroditic union. The Magnus, or higher form, highest form, represents the passage of the mind or soul into another world. It is the life-giver and leads the way to incorruptibility or immortality. This, the seed of the Iliastric soul, is the spirit of God himself, and thus the soul is in God's likeness. The first or implanted form, Sanctitus, from Sanctire, to make unalterable or unviolable, is the span of life. And I had a question here. Does this imply that the alchemists felt that lifespan was predetermined? Little information is given about the second form. Caritatis is given, aside from a reference to Rulin, who calls it the prepared Iliaster. Jung writes, there are as many Iliastri as there are men. That is to say, in every man there is an Iliaster that holds together each individual's peculiar combination of qualities. It therefore seems to be a kind of universal formative principle and principle of individuation. The Aquaaster. Jung attempts to decipher Paracelsus' formula for attaining long life, life in the manner of Enoch, grandson of Adam and predecessor of Jesus Christ. Enoch reportedly lived to 365 years of age. Jung quotes from De Vita Longa, we will explain what is most needful in this process regarding the Iliaster. In the first place, the impure animate body must be purified through the separation of the elements, which is done by your meditating upon it. This consists in the confirmation of your mind beyond all bodily and mechanic work. In this way, a new form is impressed on the impure body. Jung states that here is a key to alchemy, that it joins the purely chemical process with psychic work. And what a bit of work it is that Paracelsus requires. The body must be purified by the purification of the higher man, which requires the fivefold transformation that begins at the earthly level in Saturnine darkness and proceeds through the watery, aerial, and fiery levels, whereupon the higher man, the soul, arises from the ashes without impurities. At the same time as this transformation, the chemical mix is undergoing a parallel purifying transformation in the kiln, and the subject is imagining himself in the vessel allegorically. While Paracelsus and other philosophers and alchemists give many descriptions of both the Iliaster and the Aquaaster as non-material components of man, Jung says, whereas the Iliaster seems to be a dynamic spiritual principle capable of both good and evil, the Aquaaster, translation water star, because of its watery nature, is more a psychic principle with quasi-material attributes. Of all the Paracelsian concepts, the Aquaaster comes closest to the modern concept of the unconscious. Close quote. However, both assume material as well as spiritual form. They extend both upwards and downwards, just as matter in alchemy is material and spiritual, and spirit, spiritual and material. Therefore, what is below is like what is above, that the miracle of the one thing may be accomplished. This one thing is the lapis or filius philosophorum. This is the adept's familiar spirit, but is thus also present in every human being, and possibly in every earthly thing. The next section is Ares. Ares is the assigner who extends the peculiar nature to each species and gives individual form. It can therefore be taken to be the principle of individuation in the strictest sense. It comes from the planets, especially Mars. Other images that coincide strongly with this origin are iron and the wolf. Jung again. Ares, accordingly, is an intuitive concept for a preconscious, creative, and formative principle which is capable of giving life to individual creatures. It is thus a more specific principle of individuation than the Ilioster, and as such, it plays an important role in the purification of the natural man by fire and his transformation into an Enoch Dionis. And eventually, Ares becomes so like the Aquaster that it is scarcely possible to distinguish them conceptually. It is characteristic of Paracelsian thinking and of alchemy in general that there are no clear-cut concepts, so that one concept can take the place of another ad infinitum. At the same time, every concept behaves hypostatically, as though it were a substance that could not at the same time be another substance. This typical primitive phenomenon is found also in Indian philosophy, which swarms with hypostases. Examples of this are the myths of the gods, which, as in Greek and Egyptian mythology, make utterly contradictory statements about the same god. Despite their contradictions, however, the myths continue to exist side by side without disturbing one another. Close quote. The Melusina, which is the fourth spiritual component. The Melusina can be interpreted as a spirit, or at any rate as some kind of psychic phenomenon. For anyone familiar with the subliminal process of psychic transformation, Melusina is clearly an anima figure. She appears as a variant of the mercurial serpent, which was sometimes represented in the form of a snake woman by way of expressing the monstrous double nature of Mercurius. The redemption of this monstrosity was depicted as the assumption and coronation of the Virgin Mary. This characterization is both alchemical and Christian. Also, Jung is being unduly harsh on Melusina here, as eventually Paracelsus explains that it is Melusina who arises from the spirit and leads the spirit on its journey of transformation until the very end of the journey, when she tries to lead the spirit astray, and the spirit must realize this and reincorporate her back into itself. Then a major section called The Natural Transformation Mystery. Paracelsus' writings, though associated with Christian beliefs, are clearly apart from and somewhat contrary to them. Thus, Jung says, he used difficult language to protect it and himself. Unfortunately, this has the present effect of protecting the writings from modern interpretation. He was a conscientious physician and more prescient than many. Paracelsus believed his work supplemented God's. But the movement in intellectual Christian circles of the time was already against alchemy and magic, saying that they in fact contradicted God. Paracelsus was aware that his familiars were imaginary, but his belief lent to them an ability to influence reality. This was a precursor to psychology, when the mind affects the body as the body affects the mind. Jung says modern man should not be so fearful of superstition or mythology. Quote, one can be perfectly scientific about mythology, for it is just as good a natural product as plants, animals, or chemical elements. Close quote. Paracelsus was seeking a key to unlock the spirit from the body, which seemed to be the source of demons and diseases. The church was simply trying to banish demons, thus trying to separate nature rather than reconciling it. Like the four seasons, this is from Paracelsus, like the four seasons, the four quarters of heaven, and the four elements, the four seasons, the four quarters of heaven, and the four elements. The orienting system of consciousness has four aspects, which correspond to four empirical functions, thinking, feeling, sensation, or sense perception, and intuition. This quaternity is an archetypal arrangement. As an archetype, it can be interpreted as fantasy, imagination, speculation, and inborn faith. Jung again. Of course, we all have an understandable desire for crystal clarity, but we are apt to forget that in psychic matters we are dealing with processes of experience, that is, with transformation, which should never be given hard and fast names if their living movement is not to petrify into something static. And for me, this is where what Jung wrote became so exceedingly difficult that I could at best muddle through. So I ask you to bear with me. On the difficulties and dangers of alchemy, Jung says that in the Greek and Latin texts, there are remarks about the psychic nature of the dangers and obstacles that complicate the work. Partly they are demonic influences, partly psychic disturbances such as melancholia, but also there is the sanity-threatening danger of fascination that measureless heights and depths and paradoxes of psychic truth. So the dangers and pitfalls in the search for and identification of the inner self are warned of by Jung. Jung says that since the search for the unconscious was dangerous because it had nothing to do with the teachings of the church, and since it came from the view that Christ was a reflection of the inner being, the final section is entitled The Commentary of Gerard Dorn. And again, this is very confusing and difficult to understand. In fact, Jung himself says, the obscurities of this last chapter have no parallel in all Paracelsus writings. One would be inclined to let the whole treatise go hang did it not contain things which seem to belong to the most modern psychological insects. Well, I figured if Jung can say it, I can say it too. I felt the same. But here's the goal of the alchemists. The wholeness of being is to be transformed from a latent state of unconsciousness into an approximate consciousness of itself. He says of the pitfalls, it requires no art to become stupid. The whole art lies in extracting wisdom from stupidity. Stupidity is the mother of the wise, but cleverness never. In conclusion, I've tried to describe it, though Paracelsus describes it as a magical and alchemical process, Jung believes that he is really describing a process of psychological transformation wholly akin to what he, Jung, was trying to understand. Jung describes the relationship between the spirits and processes of alchemy and the constituents of the human being and aspects of psychology. It seems that the magics of alchemy and Christianity are so intertwined that it's impossible to differentiate them, to see where one ends and the other begins. My guess is that the ancient system of magic incorporated Christianity for the purpose of being, at times, both a means and an end. Eventually, the Christian officers tried to rip out the heretical system of magic. However, more than just vestigial remnants can be seen in Christianity if one looks closely and without prejudice. Jung was undoubtedly correct when he states that this inner conflict both tore and assisted Paracelsus. Jung does not state that the same seems to have happened to him, even as he sees himself as a direct descendant and modern parallel of the physician Paracelsus.
Yes, thank you. Very, very good. Thank you both, Molly and Dan. That's a tough chapter, and it's the one closest to Jung's own projection. It was very difficult for him to deal with that. And he was fascinated by the figure of Paracelsus. Notice, in a technical sense, he was never able to unfascinate himself from the figure of Paracelsus. There, but for the grace of God, go all of us. It's a very interesting phenomenon. The only parallel close to that was Jung's relationship with Nietzsche. But his relationship with Nietzsche is not so well understood because the 5 years that he lectured on Nietzsche has only recently been published. I have the two volumes here of all of Jung's Nietzsche lectures. And I'll set them out so you can take a look at it. But Paracelsus is much more important and close. The difference between Manly Hall and Carl Jung is that Mr. Hall was able to unfascinate himself with Paracelsus. Mr. Hall's treatment of alchemy is more sophisticated than Hume's treatment of alchemy. Why? Hume's treatment of alchemy was from the standpoint of theological psychology. Mr. Hall is dealing with it in a truly esoteric manner. That is to say, it was on an appropriate level with the peril that was in there, and was able to carry himself through that most difficult passage. Hume is certainly more famous, and probably will continue to be for some time, but Mr. Hall's work is more poignant in this regard. If you want a cultural and intellectual comparison for yourself, just as Hume was a theological psychologist, a true philosophical psychologist was William James. And if you look at William James's work, his body of work, you will get more of a philosophy of psychology than you will through Hume. Now, recently, Yale University Press published a one-volume overview of William James's life and work by a man named Myers, Gerald Myers. I think it's in a big paperback now from Yale University Press. It's a very, very good overview. It's about 600 pages, but the first 50 or 60 pages are in James's life and so forth. William James is a philosophical psychologist also penetrates through this kind of perilous fascination that Hume had a great difficulty with and did not, in my estimation, penetrate through. It's not to put Hume down. It's not to discount his work at all. But it's simply to say the bottle has a skull and crossbones on it. Use it with discretion. Your discretion. You have a right to insist on your discretion in your understanding. If you queue up to have your intellectual understanding subsumed under Hume, then you are automatically subsumed under whatever he didn't digest. Don't do that. So William James and Mr. Hall are very interesting to deal with in this connection. They're very interesting parallels to Hume. And among the three, I think William James yields the directest line into the 21st century. I like Mr. Hall the best, personally, but I think William James is the directest line. And for instance, towards the very end of his life, the last lecture that William James gave at Stanford University on the moral equivalent of war, he said, men will have peace when they work as hard for it as they do for war. The secret in there, the esoteric secret, is that man can do anything that he wishes to do if he will just do it. If he will really do that, that's what will be done. James's most poignant work, incidentally, is essays on radical pluralism. All of William James's works are published by Harvard University Press now. They're going out of print, but they all have been published, and they're in libraries. We have the complete set except one volume over here, if you wish to have a look at them. So thank you, Molly and Dan, for that. Now, I noticed that the next one, Mercurius, is Linda, Don, and Lois. And I noticed that Linda, Don, and Lois, none of them are here. So we lose. We lose that chapter. So to make up for that for yourself, you'll have to, in your own way, take a look at the Spiritus Mercurius in alchemical studies. If I get a chance later on the Tuesday evenings, those who are coming to the Tuesday evenings, I'll deal with that later on, the Spiritus Mercurius. Dan's insight is very accurate. Alchemy is a mask for Christianity in terms of its ritual procedure. And once the ritual procedure was made conscious in the 17th century, they stopped doing alchemy and they started doing something else, which was very much like a Christian yoga. And that comes to a head, incidentally, in Sir Isaac Newton. Newton is the first alchemist to be able to produce, in fact, the Heliaster physically. And it's called the Star Regulus. It's a crystalline form of antinomy. And I have a photograph of it in one of the books on Isaac Newton here, done by Betty Jo Dobbs and published by Cambridge University Press. The fact that one could, in a retort, in a laboratory, produce a Star Regulus, and this was in times when they knew nothing about chemistry, really, was unbelievable, because it showed to them that the integrative processes that produce the self also operate in material nature, and therefore they must be constant. It was absolute proof, the fact that you could turn out a Star Regulus in a laboratory. And you can see in the photograph that it's the perfect chemical result proving the existence of the self. And there was just no doubt about it to them. And in the 17th century, it was the great secret, until someone like Newton came along, who had enough consciousness and enough technique to be able to carry it out, to see that it goes beyond this. And what came after that was his great work on mathematics and physics, and the three laws of thermodynamics are actually a great advance beyond the alchemical work which you did, and there are other things. So we jump from the Spirit Mercurius then, because these people have not made it. No blame here. They may have good reasons, but the fact is they didn't show, and so we lose by that. So we come to the last one, the Philosophic Tree, and I notice that Jennifer has stopped coming, so we have just four people with us, Chris and Ed, Walter and Toshi. So just turn it over to you. Whatever form you decided on will be just fine.
Philosophical trees of different patients and the interpretation. And I'm not going to go into, I'm not going to read any of this at all, but I just was just very fascinated by the writing itself. And it is, I mean, there is just so much content, you can't begin to just sit here and even condense it. So I read it a couple of times, and probably will continue rereading it, and each time just pick up certain significance. And that's the only section that I really did read.
Okay.
Yeah. Pick up from there.
Well, after making a couple of readings of the chapter and noting sections that struck me, I did have some kind of the summa insight that I had, I wrote down this way: when the mind does not seek outside itself, for this is what dualistic operation is, to arrange, own, and relate to, then the tree of life or philosophical tree in its togetherness is disclosed. And then I added, and thou art that. I'm just hesitating because I don't have a presentation well prepared, and I'm the errors that I might transmit are that could be avoided with a more consideration of it, which could take a very great deal of time and effort, might slip through, or but some original then writing on the subject I did some more is. The philosophical tree is an alchemical symbol of wholeness.